Connolly of the Morris James firm representing the appellant reserves. At the outset, just for a minute, I want to set the stage for what I think is the way this case should be approached. In October of 2004, there was a real estate settlement under which Bellavia purchased 30 lots from reserves in the reserves development. On that day, the parties established the basic risk allocation among themselves. That risk involved, first, whether or not Bellavia would perform its obligation to pay for 42% of the construction costs. To secure that risk, that money was held by Severn Bank. There was a risk on part that reserves would pay its share of the construction costs. That risk was covered by the escrow agreement for $1,500,000. And the parties then proceeded along that basis. Today, $2.5 million of improvements have been inspected by the bank, approved by the engineer for the project to those 71 lots. Today, Bellavia has paid not a penny of its $1,085,000 share of those improvements. Today, the four principals of Bellavia, as a result of a foreclosure sale, now own the 30 lots that Bellavia purchased, and they have repaid Severn Bank $316,000, which is what Severn Bank, under the court's order in this case, was required to pay reserves as part of the $1,085,000 that was actually due from Bellavia. Reserves, of course, has spent in cashier lots that $1,085,000 together with other money for a total of $2.5 million. And Severn had the lots improved, sold the lots to the four principals of Bellavia. So Severn's been paid back by the principals. Principals of Bellavia have the lots. Reserves has stuck with the liability.
Is that all in the record?
Absolutely. There's a footnote. Your Honor, I want to make clear. That part of it's in a footnote in the brief filed by Severn. It talks about the foreclosure.
As I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the Chancery action, Reserves was asking the Vice Chancellor, in effect, to direct the payment of about $1.6 million. Is that right?
$1,450,000.
Roughly 1.5.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And the bottom line result is that the Vice Chancellor directed the payment of somewhere north of $300,000.
$313,000.
All right. And then after that, there was a final judgment in the Superior Court. If your side were to prevail in this appeal, how much money would your client be contending would have to be paid to it?
The total amount that would be paid to it by Severn Bank would be $1,085,000 plus interest, of course.
But the judgment that was entered in the Superior Court, which determined the underlying rights of the parties, was something north of $600,000, isn't that correct?
When you add the attorney's fee award, it's a little north of $700,000, but I understand the point's still the same.
So how, on what theory could your client in the Chancery action recover more than the court of law determined was the ultimate and underlying liability?
The court of law determined that there was a set-off that was owed to Bellavia as a consequence of a failure on the part of reserves to install certain geothermal wells. That set-off is a Bellavia's personal right to set off. If it turns out, and it has nothing to do, therefore, with the obligation of Severn Bank to do what it said it would do, which is to pay 42% of the construction costs. If it turns out, for example, that we prevailed in this appeal and $1,085,000 was paid to the reserves, then the Superior Court set off would then have to be, reserves having been paid, it could, of course, not collect from Bellavia. The Bellavia would still have its right of set off. And it would therefore, reserves therefore, if that right of set off, which is on appeal to this court, were upheld, then reserves would have to pay. Now, why is that right in this case?
So you, what you're saying is that if we were to reverse, then reserves would recover significantly more than the Superior Court found that it was entitled to in the ultimate merits. But some of that money would be held pending an adjudication of the setoff?
Correct.
And if your client did not prevail in that regard, then some of that recovery would be paid
Bellavia? Of course. It would have to be. The money would have to be.
Would the bottom line end up being that your client would end up net exactly what the Superior Court awarded to it or not?
That's correct. If we win this case and lose the Superior Court appeal, the appeal to this court, then the bottom line is my client ends up with around $750,000. Now, why is that right?
What is the status of that appeal?
That appeal has been briefed by the reserves, and then Crystal, one of the appellees, filed for bankruptcy. Pursuant to this court's instruction, reserves has filed an application to lift a stay in the bankruptcy court, which has now been fully briefed and is to be heard. Justice Ridgely, I don't remember the exact date. It's like 2 weeks from now. But don't hold me to that date because I just have a blank moment about when it's going to be heard by the bankruptcy court. As a consequence of that, Crystal and Bellavia have not filed their answering brief in this court in connection with the Superior Court appeal because that was stayed. So that's where that is. Now,
and just so I understand completely, why is this case proceeding when the other one is stayed?
Because Crystal is the bankrupt party. Crystal is not a party to this case.
Okay.
Now, in responding to Justice Jacobs' questions, after I gave my opening scenario and talked about why that wasn't fair, that the effect of all of this is to shift the risk that Severn Bank, as the lender, took on October of 2004. Now it's shifted to reserves. Strangely enough, the lower court briefly recognized that. On page 29 of its opinion, after discussing the whether or not reserves should be left to suing Bellavia in Superior Court, the court said, regarding the timing of a remedy, allowing Bellavia or its lender to retain all the money earmarked to pay Bellavia's share of the infrastructure costs during the prosecution of this and the related Superior Court action would allocate all of the risk to reserves. I consider that inequitable. And, of course, the court was then aware that Bellavia was broke.
There was an insolvency at that point?
It was certainly insolvent. There's a foreclosure action. All of its property has been taken into foreclosure by Severn. The property was then sold to the people who owned Bellavia in repayment of their guarantee obligation to Severn, all of which is in the footnotes in the record. The specific finding of insolvency, of course, is by the Superior Court, specifically found that. Now, I want to make three arguments today.
Are you going to touch on the mootness issue? Because if we affirm, what happens? The construction or the trust has zero money in it, right?
That was one of the three arguments I'm going to make, Your Honor. And since you asked it, I'm going to go right to that one. Now, it's interesting that in this case, the mootness claim has been filed by Bellavia, not by Severn, which suggests to me that Severn is indemnified by the principals of Bellavia who have guaranteed the Severn loan should this court increase the amount that Severn has to pay as a consequence of reversing the Chancery Court. We say that we had a direct claim. We had a damage claim against Severn Bank, and it's in our complaint. This case was litigated on the basis of certainly trying to get the court to agree to pay the trust money over to reserves because that was a way in which it was clear that Bellavia would ultimately have to repay Severn, as opposed to a separate damage claim, and then there would have to be this indemnification argument. But our arguments in the court below were direct claim arguments. The court below specifically found, and I'll read what the court below said. It said that Kroki confirmed with Wood at Severn that each time a portion of the work passed inspection, the required payment would be made to reimburse reserves for its expenditures. reserves proceeded on that basis. Court held, therefore, quote, severance, sorry to yell, I want to emphasize that point, conduct equitably stops it from denying responsibility to pay reserves. There's a direct claim in this case against Severn Bank.
But is there an order that is a direct judgment against Severn Bank?
The judgment it says that Severn Bank shall pay $313,000 from the trust. The judgment, therefore, is probably not as artfully worded as I could have done had I anticipated this kind of mootness claim would come up. But there is no, and that's what the judgment says.
It's an equitable decree that operates directly against Severn.
Yes, sir. And clearly the theory that the court below adopted to hold Severn liable is premised on direct liability. Well, the court held, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What is the theory upon which the Court of Chancery intervened to begin with? I mean, this whole action, that is, this whole dispute could have been resolved at least theoretically in the Superior Court.
The theory that I convinced the Court of Chancery to act on was that the construction project was languishing, that there was an ongoing obligation on the part of Severn to make the payments that it said it would make, and we sought specific performance of that obligation so that the project could get up and running. The court heard that argument, adopted it, right before the trial. As the opinion notes, there was an application for a stay, and the court rejected that. That's not been appealed. So there's no argument here, really, that on that point. So that's the reason why the court took this case, because it understood that there was every day there was an ongoing problem with failure to fund the construction.
Well, I understand that the cause of action may have been for specific performance. What was the underlying doctrine of equity under which the court could intervene at all, that is, assert jurisdiction,
well,
exercise jurisdiction?
There was no adequate remedy at law. Now, we understood then that Bellavia's only assets were to pay the amount that it had to pay were in effect in a bank account at Severn Bank. We argued that we had an equitable right to get those funds, and that there was no the suit against, at this point, the suit against Bellavia was going to end up being a dry hole. And the court understood that, realized we had no adequate remedy at law, and proceeded to grant us the remedy it granted us. Now, there are two points that I want to make about the court's holding. First, the unclean hands doctrine, we say, is wrong for two reasons. First, the court didn't apply the Bodley case, which certainly requires that the unclean hands defense be supported by some showing of harm. There's been no mechanics liens filed that could be upheld as a result of the land deal here. Any suit by the trustee is going to be against reserves. In fact, as the court knows from this reply brief, the trustee indeed has sued reserves. Any harm that results from the land swap deal is a reserves problem. Either it is paid for the work by the land that it lost, or it's going to have to pay in cash. But that's reserves' problem. Reserves is the party subject to the contract. Secondly, we say that apart from that legal error, if the court were to review the vice chancellor's rulings on an abuse of discretion standard, that the rulings are not logical. They're not the product of an orderly and logical process. As I've already, I think, tried to explain, the result here is to shift the party's business understanding, their business relationship, where Severn was the party undertaking the credit risk by agreeing to advance these funds to cover the costs. Now, all of a sudden, fresh reserves bears that risk. The issue here is not whether reserves has, in fact, ultimately paid all it should pay to Freshcut. That'll be determined by the lawsuit between Freshcut's trustee and reserves. The issue is whether or not Bellavia and Severn can walk away from their obligation to fund that they agreed to on October of 2004. Finally, let me touch on the equitable estoppel point. I've already noted what the court squarely held. The court squarely held the reserves conduct equitably stops it from denying responsibility to pay reserves. That's on page 39 of the opinion. The court goes on to say that at some point later, reserves should have known that Bellavia was no longer going to pay was not going to pay under its obligations, and that there was a problem with reserves paying because Bellavia was objecting. And so from that point on, there was no reasonable reliance. Well, I suggest to you that in every equitable estoppel claim, the reason there's a claim in court is because somebody's going back on their word. That's what happened here. The court found that Severn gave its word to reserves before reserves put up over $2 million in cash for letters of credit, before reserves signed a contractual obligation to go forward with press cut and pay it $3 million. Those were obligations reserves couldn't walk away from. When it found out that Bellavia wasn't going to pay, when it later found out Severn wasn't going to pay, reserves could not walk away. They were stuck. To say at that point that reserves could no longer rely on the promises seems to me to turn the whole law of equitable estoppel upside down and, in effect, make that law totally ineffective.
So all of the obligations were preceded the statement the money's not going to move that reserves is obliged to do?
That, Justice Ridgely, is exactly my point.
Do you want to reserve the rest of your time?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honor, Justices. Richard Burrell for appellee and cross-appellant Bellavia in this case. As Mr. McNally noted in his initial remarks, October of 2004 was the date of the settlement between reserves and Bellavia with respect to the transfer of the real estate. It was also the settlement of the construction loan or the purchase and acquisition loan between Bellavia and Severn. And as a part of that loan process, approximately $1.5 million, $1.4 million, was set aside in a construction trust agreement for use by or on behalf of Bellavia for future infrastructure construction. That is the fund to which the Vice Chancellor indicated that reserves had a right to recover its $315,000 plus or minus.
Mr. Burrell, what are the issues that we need to decide as you see it?
Mootness, and if the court concludes that the primary appeal is essentially moot, then the cross appeal
would be the mootness argument.
The mootness argument is that as a result of the foreclosure which has occurred, this construction trust, the construction fund, which was in fact money that belonged to Bellavia, no longer exists. It has been, the loan itself has been paid off. There's no construction loan. And there is no direct liability between reserves and Severn. And I know Mr. Arrington will comment on that as well. But the bottom line was that the money in that construction account from day one belonged to Bellavia, and it no longer exists. Once the foreclosure took place and the resulting payoff of the loan, Severn had to accept the money, had to accept the payoff. It was under no obligation at that time to preserve the trust fund, which seems to be what reserves has been arguing.
Why can't the funds be traced?
Be traced?
Yes. That is, there was money in the trust. There was a foreclosure, the money went out of the trust, and it went to Severance. Why couldn't that those monies be traced? You know, they haven't just vanished into thin air. Went into a different pocket.
The funds are there, but they were Bellavia's funds, Your Honor. They never belonged. Once the loan was made, the construction trust was established, the monies no longer belonged to Severn. They were there to be used for the benefit or by Bellavia.
But if the assuming that, just for the sake of argument, that the Vice Chancellor erred and should have directed the payment of $1 million or $1.5 million, whatever the exact number was, then in those circumstances, the trust would no longer, and Bellavia would no longer have had any entitlement to those funds, and if they were paid to Severn by way of a foreclosure rather than to reserves, those monies could be recovered from Severn, could they not?
I don't believe so, lacking some direct liability between Severn and Reserves, and that's what's missing. I mean, Severn served, or Hyatt, Mr. Hyatt served as a trustee. His only entitlement to those funds was to disperse them if and when Bellavia asked for them. But they were never his funds in the first place. They were never Severn's funds. Reserves.
Right. They were Bellavia's funds, and they happened to wind up in the hand of Severn. If Bellavia did not have an entitlement to them by virtue of a decree by the vice chancellor, then Severn's wouldn't either. That is to say, whatever legal right it may have had would have been trumped by the equity, that is the equitable right that the vice chancellor decreed existed in Reserves, right?
If the vice chancellor had ordered them to preserve those funds pending appeal, if he had ordered them to pay out to Reserve $700,000, $600,000, whatever number we're talking about, I think that's an entirely different story, Your Honor.
Well, what stayed, if anything, his order to make that payment?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Was there any stay of his order to make the payment?
No, sir. And that payment was made. The $300,000 was made, or $317,000, whatever the number was actually paid out to Reserves. But there was never any obligation on the part of Severn to retain the remaining balance of that construction trust after the trial ended. And our position on the mootness, and one of the things we raised in the mootness motion, was that Reserves had an opportunity to have asked the court to preserve those funds, to ask for an injunction or some sort of restraining order to keep the funds intact pending appeal. No doubt would have had to have posted a supersedious bond to that effect, but that request was never made. Similarly, some of the claims that Reserves had made in the...
And there's no dispute they were on notice that this was happening?
Oh, they were... The docket from the foreclosure would certainly indicate that they received notice under Rule 69, I think it is, notice to parties with liens. They were also on notice from the trial itself, the testimony of trial, that Bellavia was already at that point in default of the mortgage with Severn, and certainly should have known that the foreclosure was a possibility down the road. They had also...
Severn wasn't a bona fide mortgagee without notice of the claim that Reserves had, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. In addition, in the complaint, if you look back at the amended complaint, the Reserves asked for a restriction on Severn's right to foreclose this mortgage. That was obviously not granted by the court below and not appealed to this court. And they also asked for a super lien or a superior lien position to be established by the court. And similarly, that was not granted below and not appealed. So certainly Reserves had some sense, or at least should have anticipated the possibility that this was all going to happen and the money was going to disappear. And they simply did not ask that any stay of those funds.
Mr. Burrell, I gather you're telling us that you made in the court below a mootness argument? That is, that as a result of the foreclosure?
The mootness argument did not exist prior to the final order of the Chancery Court, Your Honor. That's something
that was not raised until appeal.
It has not. It could not have been raised until the foreclosure was completed, and that was after all the Chancery Court proceedings. With respect to the cross appeal, Your Honor, the court granted Reserves relief based on two equitable principles, unjust enrichment and equitable estoppel. Unjust enrichment, as we all know, is developed as a theory to remedy the absence of a formal contract, and equitable estoppel, which has often been viewed as something of a consideration substitute, is another of what I guess are generally referred to as quasi-contract rights of action. But in all of those instances, when the complaint alleges an enforceable contract, unjust enrichment, quasi-contract, are inappropriate sources of recovery. Now, in this particular case, the court's aware there was a fairly comprehensive contract drafted by Reserves attorneys and signed by the parties. It's been referred to as the PSA throughout the briefing. It's a two-part contract. Part of it deals with the transfer of the real estate, which took place, and then part two is basically the allocation of the construction costs and the payment of those costs. The court below, for whatever reason, concluded that that contract did not govern the matter in dispute. That was the language used at pages 27 and 28. The Vice Chancellor seemed to focus on his belief that because Bellavia...
Mr. Burrow, the Vice Chancellor held that your client was supposed to pay its proportionate share of the infrastructure cost. It didn't, and that because reserves ended up paying it, that your client was unjustly enriched. Similarly, with equitable estoppel, that is, the claim was that your client, by its conduct, misled reserves into relying on its promise, and the promise wasn't kept, therefore, thereby forcing reserves to pay your client's share of the infrastructure costs. Why is that erroneous?
Because those same remedies were available through a contract action in Superior Court. It didn't matter whether or not Bellavia took the lead in getting the construction accomplished or whether or not it did absolutely nothing. The key was whether or not it paid its share of the construction costs. And that, no matter how you look at it, is a claim for money damages. And certainly reserves recognized that at the outset by virtue of its initial action, which was filed in the Superior Court long before the Chancery action. And it is also confirmed by the fact that when you look at the relief granted by the Superior Court, it includes the relief that was for which the Vice Chancellor's order transferred funds. The same items, in other words, that Vice Chancellor Parsons found should make up part of this 317 were encompassed within Judge Stokes's decision in Superior Court, which in our view very clearly shows that this was a contract action from day one.
So that judgment has been partially satisfied?
In effect, it has been by virtue of the transfer, Your Honor. I would view it that way.
So what is the net amount then owing under the Superior Court judgment?
I don't have an exact number. Mr. McNally had some general numbers, 750 minus 317, I think, was what was transferred, essentially.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. May it please the Court, I'm Michael Arrington of Parkowski, Girk & Swayze, the attorneys for Severn Savings Bank and Attorney Alan Hyatt. I'd like to address a couple of points, but I know the Court has already asked a couple of questions that I'd like to provide some information. The first was, where did the language come from in the judgment? And the answer is, it's a direct quote from page 51 of the Vice Chancellor's decision that says, defendants Severn and Hyatt shall pay that amount from the construction trust directly to reserves on behalf of Bellavia to be applied toward Bellavia's share of the infrastructure costs. That's the limit that the Court placed on it. It's just saying, Severn, you're holding Bellavia's funds. You pay this limited amount of Bellavia's funds until the Superior Court resolves the final dispute among them all. And Justice Ridgely, yes, the $316,000, which included post-judgment interest, was paid by Severn. And Justice Jacobs, we were on notice of that, and that was paid before the foreclosure action so that we had satisfied what the Court of Chancery had told our bank to do.
Well, actually, your client was on notice that reserves was claiming a property interest in a lot more than $300,000+.
We knew that they had sued in Superior Court. We knew they had a judgment against them, but we had a first position mortgage. And that's part of what the problem is, and one of the points that I was going to speak about, unless you have other questions as we move along, is what the implication is for banking and for lending in Delaware. If you remember, reserves sought a first position lien. Go over Trump and have well, equitable sub.
If you're going to be talking in those big picture terms, then favor us with your view of what the precise issue is.
Thank
as
you.
It relates to Severn.
I would like to, and they are matters of equity and law. If you'd like me to go directly to the banking industry, I would be happy to do that. Because if I'd ask you to review what's at issue in the case, reserves sought a priority lien position over the lender's secured first position money mortgage, purchase money mortgage. Reserves was not a party to any loan document. It had no privity of contract with the lender. It had no privity on the note or mortgage. It was not a party to the trust that the borrower's funds were held. And it was Reserve's own actions that created default for Bellavia and unnecessary risk to the lender that was found by the court.
Now, that request for priority was addressed to the vice chancellor, and he denied it?
It was the number one request they had. It was equitable subrogation of that mortgage. In other words, we know that Severn had risk as to Bellavia's loan for the purchase of the property, a portion of which was in a construction trust.
And what was where is his rationale appear for denying that?
I would have to look at the order. I don't have it specifically, but he does address that all other claims for relief are denied. And I believe it's just before the unjust enrichment argument in his decision. But he clearly found that he had no third-party status on this. And we keep hearing again through the briefs and through argument.
Excuse me, Mr. Arrington, the question I had asked you before is, what is the issue that we have to decide as it relates to your client?
We did not appeal, so we believe that the vice chancellor properly exercised his discretion, that there is limited discretion. So the issue is, that we would like you to consider, is did the vice chancellor abuse his discretion in awarding limited relief? We know that equitable remedies in the Court of Chancery are subject to review and only by the standard of abuse of discretion.
Okay, but that's the surface issue. In order to decide that, there have to be some underlying issues. Do there not?
Well, as you read through our brief, I think the argument we were making is that Severn never made a statement at any time to reserves that it would pay reserves. It did say that money would come from Bellavia's trust account to Bellavia to be paid to reserves. So the attempt at this point to come back and recapture more than the court ordered is beyond the order that the vice chancellor put in place that we believe was reasonably calculated.
I'm sorry, I don't understand what you just said.
I'm not saying it's very well then.
You would have us conclude that the vice chancellor abused his discretion in awarding the relief he did.
No, sir. If you remember, we did not file appeal because we recognize the standard is abuse of discretion, and while we disagree with him, we don't feel that it was an abuse of discretion. He has the right to determine what was reasonable and what was unreasonable under the facts of the case. And I think both of our
are you arguing that we should affirm?
Absolutely. Because it is concluded. Severn did what Alan Hyatt, the trustee, said we will do. I can't disperse funds, Vice Chancellor, from Bellavia over their objections and even over reserves objections without a court order. They gave him a court order for $316,000. They satisfied what the vice chancellor told them to do and then proceeded to execute on their proper first position mortgage. They weren't, once that had happened.
Okay, let me, pardon me for interrupting, but I understand
it's your time,
your position is that the Court of Chancery did not commit any error or abuse of discretion in doing what it did. But your colleague on the other side is arguing that the Court of Chancery should have done a lot more and erred by not doing so.
And we say that they did not err because they did exercise proper discretion. And the reason is because reserves and Mr. Karatke, who was the principal in this case, knew when Will Esham of Bellavia said, we're done, no money's going, that no money was to be done, no money was to be spent. The Court of Chancery did not abuse its discretion when it said, when you started doing a land swap that caused risk for Bellavia and for Severn, and by the way, there were mechanics liens filed, that cuts off the reasonableness. You were only reasonable up to a point, and you know what?
I understand your opponent's argument is that reserves was obligated to satisfy its contractual obligations made in reliance upon the promise that was made, and that it's just following through on what it had to do, and that this notion of you can no longer detrimentally rely when someone says we're not going to pay when the reliance has already occurred is a misapplication of the law.
Okay. And, of course, we have argued that there was never a promise that we're going to pay reserves. We are going to pay Bellavia upon its request to reimburse. And there is a contractual obligation between Bellavia and reserves that has been decided at $600,000. That's not what they want to do is they want to shift the collection burden from Bellavia over to Severn when Severn has satisfied all of what it was supposed to do under its reasonableness standard.
Now, the Vice Chancellor said that the promissory estoppel point about no longer being able to rely was not the only reason he limited equitable relief. What was the other reason?
Unclean hands. Actually, it was the kind of a flip of that, Justice Ridgely. The argument that came back in the motion for re-argument was Vice Chancellor, you denied us partial relief because of unclean hands, and under Bodley you can't do that. And what he said was, I didn't deny it solely on unclean hands. I denied it on a lack of a showing. It was a less convincing showing. He did not make a clear and convincing showing that after you were on notice that the funds were in dispute and that they were being objected to by Bella Via and the trustee has a fiduciary duty, at that point you've made a less convincing showing, particularly when what you did is you swapped land instead of paying money. Reserves didn't pay money on it. In fact, if you look through numbers on it, Reserves sold their lots to Bella Via for $125,000, yet they want to claim $250,000 of payment toward Fresh Cut, which was in bankruptcy. And those were the subject of multiple cases back and forth about deeds going to and deeds coming from. So there was substantial risk going on, and what Reserves has really done is said, listen, we want reimbursement for double the value that we sold to you for, and we want to collect it from you, Bella Via, and because we don't think you have any money, we want to go after the bank, which we now want to refund a non-existent trust account that it properly foreclosed on with its first position mortgage. The implications are really what I was hoping you would want to focus on in particular. I think we've addressed the other arguments I wanted to make, so I'd be happy to address other questions you might have, or I would cede my 1 minute to Mr. Burl if you have other questions for him.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to speak, I think, about the mootness point so that we're clear. Mr. Burrell says that Severn Bank, not his client, Severn doesn't make this motion, this mootness point, had no obligation to preserve the trust fund. Severn Bank was sued for $1,085,000. It knew there was an appeal filed, and it never told. There's nothing in this record that says that Severn Bank told Reserves that it was going to, quote, cancel the trust. There's a foreclosure proceedings. That is it. Until we get the mootness brief filed in this court is the first time we find out that the guarantors of Bella Via have stood up and paid back Severn. That's the first. We don't even know what the arrangement is between Severn and the guarantors with respect to the results of this appeal.
Is your argument that this issue is not properly before us?
Precisely. Precisely, Justice Jacobs. Does anyone really believe that while this appeal was pending for $1,085,000 that Severin said to the principals of Bella Via, we're done, you don't owe us any more money? That's not in their record. There's nothing. There's no understanding of what's going on here in the record. And I think it kind of odd that a party who knows an appeal is pending can simply make an argument, or have Mr. Burl make the argument, that it can just walk away from the possibility that it'll have to pay a judgment for that amount. The funds are there. It's just in a different bank account.
Is it possible that the decision in this case will have an impact on the appeal if and when it proceeds in the Superior Court action?
No. The appeal in the Superior Court action may have an effect on the disposition of any funds that are awarded to Reserves, because if this court were to reverse and $1,085,000 less what was paid is paid to Reserves, my understanding is, I expect, that Bella Via will then come to the Chancery Court or this court and seek an order that the funds that it had claimed in his counterclaim as a set-off be escrowed or be somehow secured so that Reserves doesn't use that money. If it turns out that this court in the Superior Court case denies Reserves appeal and upholds the set-off that Bella Via got so as to reduce the $1,085,000 down to whatever the number is, then that money will be there and will be turned over to Bella Via, presumably in turn go back to Severn, of course, to satisfy that obligation.
So if I understand correctly, the only issue in the Superior Court appeal will be whether the set-off was proper?
Well, there's a couple of other issues, but there's another issue having to do with this land swap contract That's right, because we, in the Superior Court case, it's hard for me to argue that case, but I'll try it quickly. In the Superior Court case, Judge Stokes also said, well, you don't get a full reimbursement for the $1,085,000 that you spent because some of that was in land, and I'm not going to give you full credit for the land. And so we're arguing that as well, that under the contract, there was no obligation to pay on the part of reserves before it got reimbursed. This contract says get a bill, 10 days later you got to pay us.
But the major dollar issue is the setoff.
Yes, sir.
Did anyone ask either the chancellor or the president judge to consider having one judge sit in both courts to preside over these matters?
Your Honor, I thought about that, and I didn't do it, and I don't have any particular reason not to do it. It's just, it's kind of touchy sometimes to do that. And Judge Stokes clearly was on top of the case and was going to hear it. If the reason for the delay is he had a murder trial in the middle of the whole thing, and he had to delay it. That's why. But I thought about it, and I didn't do it. And I don't, honestly cannot remember why we didn't ask the Vice Chancellor or for that matter, Judge Stokes, to try the case together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement and have a brief recess.